Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Painter Fikre Gabriesus and filmmaker Mantia Diawara meet metaphorically in this program focusing on their work. Political refugees, activists, scholars, and storytellers, both men settled in the United States and found themselves working odd jobs, joining the African-American community of poets and each digging into his own artistic practice. Gabriesus' epic painting, The Sardine Fisherman's Funeral, combines symbols, historical references, and iconography from different cultures to express a depth of feeling for the power of the sea. Diawara's film, An Opera of the World, based on the African opera Bintu Ware, mines the Malian filmmaker's own migration experience against the backdrop of recent tragedies among refugees on the Mediterranean Sea. In this post-screening conversation, held on March 23, 2019, at the National Gallery of Art, Mantia Diawara and poet, essayist, playwright, scholar, and president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, Elizabeth Alexander, discuss and contrast Gabriesus' painting and Diawara's filmic inquiry into the power of bearing witness.
So, The Sardine Fisherman's Funeral. We are talking about an epic painting, The Sardine Fisherman's Funeral. And so I'm going to start with a short clip, just 3 minutes, from a film called The African Sublime of Fikre Gebreyesus, where the Ethiopian-American painter Julie Meretu and I meet in Fikre's studio and discuss his work, the intersections of his work with her work, and in the short section that we're going to show, The Sardine Fisherman's Funeral. So this is the sardine fisherman's funeral. The idea is you're a sardine fisherman and you have your fish coffin, because that's the coffin that says something about the life that you lived. So he thought that was just really, really, really interesting.
You know, you have these Coptic angels, but they're very individualized. So the thing that I don't know and that I wonder is, who is this? Who is this? Who is this? Who is this? Because they seem very, very specific, and also very specific in their expressions. And I think that she's a little bit distressed. So in thinking about, you know, some of the anxiety in his paintings, that seems really interesting to me. This is also a reprise of some very, very, very early paintings.
I was going to say that.
Yeah,
I
right?
I was going to say that, yeah, like the departure paintings.
Exactly.
Like. Yeah.
In a different palette, but the same sense of, you know, kind of women gathered and overlapping and shrouded, and in the way that perhaps, you know, you might gather in a church setting or in a mourning setting as well. And I'm just really interested here about
that face.
The face,
right?
Yeah.
And the sketched out faces with the, you know, color coming through. And I think of our ghost earlier that we were looking at in 100 years.
Yes.
And there's more to say. I mean, I think also, you know, what that umbrella was in a Habesha context.
Yeah, part of the kind of ritual of religious ceremony and religious marches. In the Coptic church, priests would march with the umbrellas. And early on, both the king and the queen were under umbrellas, and also the high priests.
So I remember when he was making this painting, and this figure migrated. So the figure was somewhere else, and then, you know, and he said, I can't, I don't know what this is, but I can't stop making it, and I know that this needs to be here. And then finally one day he said, it's Mengistu Haile Mariam.
Yeah. The terrorist.
Yeah. Like, that's who won't stop haunting the picture, and that's why we're at a funeral in the first place, I think. That's a scary face.
Yeah. It doesn't have, to me, the kind of emotional resonance that this face has.
That's right.
Or that face.
Yep.
Or this face. This almost feels like someone in prayer, like bending down. But then this whole infrastructure, because it's almost like it's on their shoulders or on their back.
Something to marvel at about him that I used to wonder, you know, how can someone who has lost so much, who's been separated from his family, who's seen so much death up close, who's had his home broken into by soldiers, who's, you know, really, really lived through actually a terrorist regime. How does any human being come out of that with so much profound joy?
Okay, so that's just a little clip to take us inside the painting. I wanted to tell you that I'm taking us through what I see as some of the references in the painting, which holds so much, and I had the privilege earlier today of listening to the teacher's workshop as they worked with the painting and were exquisitely led through it and offered up many, many thoughts on this painting, which I know so well that I have never had about it. So it is open to the public and open for interpretation. But today I'm using my tools as a scholar of Black culture. I'm using my tools and my vantage point of being married to Ficre when most of his 882 paintings and hundreds of photographs were made in an artistic partnership that meant that no line or word went unscrutinized by the other, literally, in the time that we had together. He passed away almost 7 years ago. And finally, I also bring the poet's modus operandi of speculation, dwelling in what the poet Etheridge Knight in his great poem, The Idea of Ancestry, called the space between. He said, I float in the space between. And so that's what we get to do when we are poets trying to make meaning when not everything is always clear. And then finally, I'll give you a quick run through of a selection of his works to give a sense of the entire body of his work as it leads us towards the sardine fisherman's funeral. And in our conversation, the topic of migration is obviously front and center along with so much else. So in thinking about the many, many, many things that Ficre saw, the many things his eyes sought, the many things his curiosity sought, he was born and grew up in Asmara, Eritrea, left when he was 16 for Sudan, then Italy, then Germany, and then New Haven, Connecticut, where he ended up spending the larger part of his life. There is so much, if you look at this, and I would like to add that our son, Simon, who is now a 19-year-old budding art historian who is studying the art of the African diaspora, contributed to this. And so he wrote me one day and sent me this and said, you know, Mama, look, it's the sardine fisherman's funeral. Would Daddy have seen these angels? Would Daddy have seen these paintings? And certainly with his hungry eye. If you think about the Coptic angels, with which he would have been familiar in the church in which he grew up, the sense of narrative and of the power of color, his interest in large, unstretched canvases that dovetails with his interest in frescoes, in wall paintings. If you look at this, you can get an understanding of why the borders of the painting are deliberately left unpainted, because he thought of it as a wall painting of sorts. And the Orthodox rituals, the church as a site for biblical storytelling, but also for continuity and family storytelling that goes back for centuries and has a particular valence in the face of ongoing war and subsequent diaspora. So when he came to making these large canvases, there was also the influence of the Scrovegni Chapel of Giotto, the great colorist of European church paintings. He said that he always thought that Giotto was actually a little bit African because of the intensity of that blue. he felt that that was supra-European blue. And I think that also in this work, we see a profound understanding culturally arisen of the proximity of life to death and the importance of ritual and community. Even as communities are remade in diaspora, how do we carry our people across the line between life and death? And so hear more if you think about these as some of the influences we might look to. And here, if you look at these gathered women in a similar composition, here, some of our extraordinary angels. I think of this painting as a Pan-African fantasia that also calls to mind a phrase associated with Romare Bearden's work, which we'll look at in a moment, the prevalence of ritual. Here is a family photograph, and I would also love to acknowledge that there is family here, and particularly my brother and sister-in-law, my brother and sister, Sara and Gideon Ghebreyesus. And Sara is in this picture, and we weren't able to find, but if you look at this, so this is Fikre's style in there on the left in the suit. There he is with their beautiful parents in the center and many family members gathered around. And Fikre's three sisters, Sara, Mehret, and Tadelech, go across the top. There was another picture that was taken that day that just had the sisters. So I want you to look at these ladies and imagine a picture just of these sisters with their heads closer together. And that photograph was one that Fikre was obsessed with. That was what he called his three graces. He had this picture in his studio. He Xeroxed it. He painted it. He sketched it. He did it every which way. And as I was thinking about this, I thought that the three graces certainly make their way into the angels. And if you think about also the sculptural quality of black hair, which fascinated Fikre quite infinitely, what have become colored headdresses here actually, I think, emanate from extraordinarily arranged in different ways black hair of his fabulous and gorgeous sisters, the troika of his imagination. And here too, Bearden's work, The Block, Fikre's sense of the importance of epic, of communities telling their tale in epic form. So right now at the California African American Museum, another of his epic paintings is up, Zememesh Berhe's Magic Garden. There are several of these. He was always working on one of his epic unstretched canvases, even as he was working simultaneously in different sizes. And so that sense also of what does it mean to look intimately into community as it is going through the ritual of everyday life, and those are, of course, also the rituals of life and death, is why I think The Block was very important to him. Also, I wondered, this one, also Simon found this, a Mende sacred shrine from Mali in the 13th century. He couldn't then, you know, he's 19, I said, well, tell me about it. He said, I don't know, it was a slide in the lecture. but I thought that perhaps Professor Diawara or perhaps Professor Nelson could tell us more. But if you look at that particular fish, I think that that is also something that we see echoed in the painting. And it's important to recognize that, you know, Fikre, an East African, passed further through Africa, through Europe, to the United States, where, among other things, he also became African American. And that even before he left Asmara, the sounds of the black world, the images of the black world were inside of him. He was listening to Fela. He was listening to Motown. He was listening to all of these different kinds of musics, understanding himself as part of a diasporic culture. So I think that where we see West African influences is important to note in that regard. And so here, too, these extraordinary Ghanaian fantasia coffins. This tradition of coffin making began with the Ga people of southern Ghana and continues to the present, reflecting the belief that there's another form of life after death and that revered deceased people, loved ones, must be properly ushered into death, where they will become ancestors far more powerful than those on earth and able to influence the living in an ongoing fashion. These coffins are only seen on the day of the burial and reflect sometimes the occupation, but also the status of the deceased. They are referred to as custom, fantastic, or proverbial coffins made by very specialized craftspeople and were shown in the landmark exhibition, and Fikre had this catalog, so he wouldn't have seen the exhibition, but the catalog was well-thumbed and he was fascinated with it, an exhibition of African art called Magicien de la Terre at the Musée National d'Art Moderne in Paris in 1989. So there are the Ga coffins. And here again, that detail. Among the mourners, an outline figure, and we talked about it in the film, in the lower left corner, echoing an angel at the other diagonal on the page in outline. This would be a ghost, an absent present. The recurrent shape also we see of the compound gate, which is what you see kind of right before, is something that we see in a lot of Fikre's work, and I think it helps us think about, again, ritual passage from life into death. The fabric ladder hangs over the side of the boat, but upon which premise would anyone climb in and out of a coffin. The Coptic angels are sentries across the top, near ancestors present, guarding the community and at the ready to usher the exiled body into the ancestral domain. And if you think about the fragility and that mysterious outlined figure, which, as I've said, Fikre, I wondered aloud to me why he couldn't paint it out, why it persisted, why it was so familiar, why it had to remain in the frame. 500,000 people were killed on Mengistu's watch during the Red Terror of 1977 to 8, the period in which his own extended period, Fikre's, as a refugee began. The angels, I believe, ultimately have more heft and weight in the picture than this sinister figure, but the sinister figure remains. To quote Fikre from his artist statement, "I started painting 10 years ago, but I suspect I've been metaphorically doing so all my life. When I started painting, I just did it. I never felt a stronger urge. The pieces that flowed out of me were very painful and direct. They had to do with suffering, persecution, and subsequent psychological dilemmas I endured before and after becoming a young refugee from the independence war in my natal home. Painting was the miracle, the final act of defiance through which I exorcised the pain and reclaimed my sense of place, my moral compass, and my love for life. From Eritrea, I found myself in New York City, where my tiny kitchen table instantly became the studio table." So for a bit of context to zip through, these are some very, very early paintings, mostly large, dark canvases lit with brilliant corners of insistent life, giving, I think, a sense of a home in wartime. He said, quote, "Asmara is a beautiful city at 8,000 feet above sea level, planned and designed by Italian colonialists at the turn of the century. In addition to the collision of architectures, iconography, and propaganda art, there was the unique and palpable visual aesthetic of death. Soviet tanks rumbled through the streets, fighter planes strafed the skies, and deadly uniformed soldiers rummaged through the streets, a medieval vision of hell incarnate. Government-sponsored death squads had powers of emergency over any Eritrean citizen. I suppose I have carried this angst and fear of imminent explosion within me to this day, for when I paint, I am accompanied by dissonance, syncopation, and the ultimate will for life and moral order of goodness." When he came and spent time in New York working as a young student activist, working in many kitchens always, and also taking classes at the Art Students League, working at the Senke Gallery, and where he learned the work of many of the great African-American artists, Hale Woodruff, Charles Alston, Romare Bearden, and he also worked in Bob Blackburn's printmaking workshops. And so here we see just early work in New York, where he's starting to, and Professor Diawara talks about in his amazing book, We Won't Budge, the significance of the murder of Amadou Diallo to so many people, and to so many African immigrants in particular. And so I think what's interesting is that you also see a sense of crowdedness, suspicion, fear, joy, beauty, but also of anxiety in some of these early paintings. But what we also see is his palette changing dramatically, moving into the powerfully and uniquely color-driven work that he will become known for. But I'll add another visual influence, and this also from his artist statement. "A trip to the market guaranteed a dazzling range of traditional crafts repeated from one generation to the next without ongoing critical intervention and independent of religious function. These crafts included a range of works such as reed baskets and hand-spun, hand-woven embroidered cotton garments of exquisitely resolved colors. The caves near my mother's village are full of prehistoric rock drawings and paintings. My eyes took in all of this. My painting allowed me to finally process the seemingly dissonant visual information. The painter as individual, however, without church or mosque affiliation and sanctioned by civilians and government, is a relatively new concept for us in Eritrea, 40 years old at most. When I paint in my studio in New Haven, some 5,000 miles away from home, I still find myself reacting to this reality. My normative experience is inescapably Eritrean, and as it turned out for me, I also have to respond and account for the stimuli and influencing forces I find myself open and vulnerable to because of my life here. So I have been able to cull the various forces such as bebop, modern jazz, Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, polyrhythms of the African diaspora, and the great many paintings that I spend time viewing in museums when I can take time off. I am continually recontextualizing those experiences in my work as a chef, where I have found myself integrating cross cultures into dishes. I have become a conscious syncretizer. My cooking is how I make my living, but I have also been able to make a creative experience that in fact complements my painting philosophy. And I think of Professor Diawara talking about being welcomed to become who he was, to become a professor of literature, that becoming. These, I want you to see, if you look toward the bottom in the kind of celadon-wide strip, there are a number of Ficre's works resonant with this film where there's a recurring motif of the interred figures or the figures underwater. So this figure of the perils of migration, not only his own migration, but the migration of many, many others, an awareness of that, and also his own claiming of the middle passage that created Africans in diaspora, brought into slavery, was something that was a very, very important fundamental concept to him. And so just taking you through these solitary waters, solitary boats, and interred figures. More Coptic angels fused with musicians. I mean, again, I can barely like not talk about these. But just to give you a little bit of a sense also of the color drive in so much of his work, this just because it's magical. And here again, you see, you know, the soldier behind the sofa, the interred figures in the home, the haunting, some of these figures merging with some of the ways that we see the Coptic angels. And I think what's also so interesting is if you look at the art on the walls, that painting that is in the far back, yellow with white figures and a black border, this to me almost feels like the artist in his studio without the figure of the artist painting along these very themes. This important painting, Manja Libro, a childhood name of Ficre's, Manja Libro, book eater. And indeed, he was a consumer of words, of ideas, of images. But here, I think also with these extraordinary watery bottoms, what we see, as in the Sardine Fisherman's Funeral, and I talked about this with the teachers earlier today, I don't know that there is a sardine fisherman per se. You know, this is not representation. This is syncretization. This is the artist's imagination. This is the process of distilling and making into something else, which I think is really very, very evident in that painting and in so many others. This one is called 100 Years. If you look, I like it because it has books in it. 100 Years of Solitude over there, and also a self-portrait in that frame, which again, we've seen again, this extraordinary nude with bottle tree moving quickly. One of the long murals, city with a river running through. Gate to the compound, so here where you see the memory of the magic garden, the compound, the home that he grew up in, a very extraordinary place, but also you see the doors open, the moat or body of water in front is impossible, another lonely boat, and then soldiers inside the compound. But here the compound is intact in Zememish Berhe's magic garden with a bottle tree that he has borrowed from West African in the Americas iconography. And that was very meaningful to him. And so finally, and I've written about this painting, but every morning and every night, I open and close my eyes to Ficre's painting Visitation. It allegorizes our first meeting in the State Street studio where I met him when I walked through a door that literally said Foster Kindness on it as graffiti into my future. In the painting, a man and a woman meet with offerings. For the woman, scarlet red tomatoes, her own fecundity held in cupped hands at her womb. She is wearing all white, the white of the Yoruba goddess Yemaya, with her blue nearby in the background, and the white of Obatala, the creator of all human bodies. The solemn brown man humbly offers his eye on a plate. That is what Ficre gave to all of us, his eyes on the world. We stand inside of him and have the privilege of seeing out as he did. The eye is also an icon, a protective evil eye that a caretaker offers his coming family. As in so many paintings, including the Sardine Fisherman's Funeral, he has created a spirit house. Though the pair is meeting for the first time, they are surrounded by the images of the children they will soon have, and their sons are painted as Coptic angels, for in Ficre's work, there are angels everywhere in landscape where ancestors are both remembered and conjured in the future. A curtain of flowers rains down over the woman's space, illuminating her. It has Ficre's characteristic sense of what has been called tutti, the unshakable belief in beauty, in overflow, in everythingness, in despite, In the bursting, indelible beauty in a world where there is so much suffering and wounding and pain, as he well knew, a world in which he walked close to death from birth, but always with ancestors by his side. And then just a few of his photographs. And there he is. So thank you very much. So, we'll have a conversation.
Okay.
So much has happened. I guess I will begin I would love to know more about the making of the film, how you came to make it, and some of the complicated details of how you made it and brought together so many interesting pieces.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to also thank the National Gallery of Art for bringing me here, and Mele and Elizabeth, who was a former student, but now president of the Mellon. I put on the tie because as I'm meeting the president. So that's the, so President Elizabeth Alexander. First of all, this talk about Faye Ray's work was so brilliant. It was so moving because Africans who crossed the ocean to come here, like myself, economic immigrants and so on, now for slavery, one of the things that we learned from African Americans that we see in the fisherman's, sardine fisherman's funeral, is that we left Africa with one identity, but when we come to the United States, we become multiple. And that multiplicity that you can see in the painting, where you have, Edward Gleeson calls this the new Baroque, not the 17th century Baroque, but the new Baroque, where the past, the present, and the future, because immigrants usually don't look at the future, they look at, the past, and then the present, and how to return home with whatever they return with. But in this case, you see the future, you see the past, you see the present, and you see the multiplicity with the Ghanaian casket, of course. So that really, the way you did the exegesis of all of this was brilliant, and thank you very much for doing that. It was really great stuff. Thank you. It was... I need a writer like this to talk about my work. It was brilliant. Now, the film, I was invited to Bamako, I'm from Mali, to be at the premiere of the opera, the Sahel Opera, which was produced by the Prince Claus Foundation, Prince Claus of Netherlands. So they wanted a Malian intellectual. And I have done some work with them. So they asked me to come. I said, well, if I come, I have to bring my camera. Mm-hmm. And then what you see in the film is that there are different cameras, some very old-fashioned ones and some current, present, up-to-date ones. So I took a cameraman from Accra and then hired two more people in Bamako, and I just told them, film all the rehearsal, film everything. And then they said, well, would you make a documentary about it? I said, sure. So I brought the images back to New York and just put them in my archive. Mm-hmm. This is 2007. Mm-hmm. And then Documenta asked me to do a project for them in 2017. Mm-hmm. And then without realizing it, I said, okay, I want to do a film on an opera. And they say, oh, yeah, that's great. So I really did not know what I was getting myself into. Mm-hmm. So that's when I went through my archives. But I also, I'm a professor, didactic. So I wanted to do 10 films because I have to tell a story. Yeah. So I had to bring all these two things together. Mm-hmm. And how do I do it? Mm-hmm. So the filmmaking process was very interesting in that sense. But I was lucky because Documenta is the biggest art institution in terms of, it's every 5 years. But they told me, they gave me all kind of art editors. Mm-hmm. but I found a Syrian in Athens in Greece. So we make the film every night. I listen to the song at the end, which my mom used to listen to. And she claimed that Fanta Damba, who was the greatest diva in Bamako, she would be your Ella Fitzgerald or Aretha Franklin, basically. So I would listen to that song every night in order to think about what I'm going to do the next day. And my Syrian editor, he said he will cry every night because the Syrian crisis were going on at that time. But I was very lucky, to make the long story short, everybody understood my project. It was my easiest, the most complex, but the easiest one, because I wanted to look at immigration from the beginning of the world. Not just the people you see today. So because people understood it, we had archivists, we have all kind of people. So it was an easy film to make because it's our stories. You can see your story in my story, and I can hear my story in, you know, Fikre's story. It's that kind of thing.
You know, you talk about the didacticism, in, to use that word in a good way, I think, because the talking heads in this film, the didacts are extraordinary. And, you know, serious intellectuals giving us very, very clear understandings, absolutely applicable to the here and now. Have you thought about, you know, how, you know, kind of the uses of the film and to where we stand right now with increasing xenophobia?
Yeah, the film has been shown a lot in Europe because it's the German documentary is really produced in Kassel, Germany. So therefore, and then it was edited in Athens. So it was shown a lot in museums and different places in Europe, in Mali and Senegal, Lagos, Nigeria. In the US, it started being shown after Black History Month. So people start, you know, the Black Museum, different places. But I'm not gonna lie, when I was making the film, I had America in mind every day. You know, they have not totally started talking about the walls, but they were talking about building the wall. So, you know, the film is doing its own little road. You know, I knew all the people, I read their work first before interviewing them. The the African woman in the film, Fatou Diom, she's one of the biggest novelists. She wrote a book called Le Ventre de l'Atlantic, The Belly of the Atlantic. It's an amazing book. So I read that and interviewed her. Richard Sennett is my colleague at NYU, and he loves the opera. He used to invite me to his apartment all the time and play cello for me. And then Alexander Klug, when I was a graduate student, the New German Critique was a major area for theory. You know, a critical inquiry, the New German Critique, the Frankfurt School, basically. So that's how I met him. And Nicole LaPierre is a very close friend of mine. She's an anthropologist living in Paris. So I read their work, and I come to a particular moment in the work. I say, can you talk about this area? So that's how I put I use them as characters in the film as opposed to expert or in.
That was just beautiful. And I think, you know, something, so you've wrote a memoir that I love, that Fikre loved so much, We Won't Budge, about your story of coming here as a young person and coming, spending many years right here in Washington, D.C., when you first came to the United States. And the book is simultaneously set in Bamako, in Washington, D.C., in Paris. It made me think of, you know, and I wanted just today call the name of Okwie Nwezor, you know, a great, great, great recent loss, the Nigerian curator who, if you go back, he was very well obituaried in the New York Times, and it closed with a quotation for him where he said, "Where the oceans meet each other, that's where I belong."
That's right.
And so I thought about, you know, those interstices, those junctures, that's belonging at more than one place simultaneously, and thinking about your life and work, Fikre's life and work. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, well, actually, our lives, I also came to Washington, D.C. In 72, 73. And last night, I had a nostalgic moment. Every single restaurant where I worked has shut down. Mm. It made me so sad. Sans Souci, La Bagatelle, Chez Dominique, and Geppetto. And then I just, oh yeah, that closed down. And so that was a really bad moment for me. But you know, I worked in these restaurants, learned Spanish in these restaurants.
As did Figre. He loved that shared experience.
And then also met, you know, I was a dishwasher, I was at the pantry. Mm. And this is one of the areas we don't talk enough about. 99% of migrants want to come here or go to France or go to Africa and work very hard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'll never have washed dishes in Mali. I'm an African man, very important, you know, so I'll now wash dishes. But in Washington, D.C., I washed dishes. I did all, because it's a way of being, you know, the sardine fisherman's funeral is actually a rebirth in that sense. Mm-hmm. You know, you come here, die, and then, you know, you become reincarnated all over. Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me. I came here as a tribal man. Mm-hmm. I'm a Soninke from the Ghana Empire. It was Ted Jones who sent me here. So, you know, that's another romantic story.
Yes,
you come here, and through the African-American search for freedom, you die and become born again, and you become a different kind of person. I think that's what I have in common with him. Mm. That is, until you identify with the most oppressed person, whether it is black, white, man, woman, gay, you are still in this rooted identity, and you are an oppressor. Whether you African or you European, you are an oppressor. But when you begin to identify with that person seeking freedom, then you become a new person. That's what I had in common with him. Mm-hmm. And we learned that. I mean, for me, it was easy to learn because I was doing literature. Mm-hmm. I knew it right. I met Ted Jones at Shakespeare and Company in Paris. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be like him. He said, look, man, you know, In America, people are very racist against African Americans. They say black people in those days. And then in Paris, they don't like Africans. He gave me literally the addresses of all the people, you know, that I will become friends with. He gave me the addresses and told me to come to America. Try to go to Harvard. They didn't accept me, but I went to American U. So you learn something new about yourself. That does not, you know, I'm very proud to be Malian, Soninke, Ghana Empire, but I'm way more complex than that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I learned, and I'm sure that's Fikre's history too. How do you get a gun? I mean, Ethiopians are so proud. They never, Eritrean, never been colonized. Mm-hmm. And then you get a Ghanaian casket in the middle of the painting. Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. That's really powerful.
Well, I think what's, you know, and you write about this and We Won't Budge, I think the, you know, the complexity and courage of saying, I am of what I come from. But I am not still exactly that I come from.
Exactly, yes. Yep.
Which actually, I mean, that's what we ask artists and intellectuals in part to do for us, to shine that light, to lead the light of human evolution.
That's right.
You know, that we can all evolve if we let ourselves. If we let ourselves, you know, as we heard in the film, let yourself actually be touched by other human beings. Yeah. But there's a lot of pressure also that's saying, and we saw that in the opera, you know, go back.
That's right.
Take back, you know, that's always for everyone the goal.
The author, I'm writing a book now on Edouard Glissant from Martinique, French intellectual of Caribbean origin, Martinique. And Glissant says, je peux changer en échangeant avec l'autre sans me détruire ni me dénaturer. You can change through exchange with the other, or transaction with the other without destroying yourself or alienating yourself. Because you are becoming multiple. I can learn from your spirituality, and you can learn from my spirituality. This was very important to Edward Gleeson. You know. So this exchange, this notion of multiplicity, is very threatening to most people. You don't want to leave your home because you don't want to be corrupt. You don't want to be alienated. So you don't want to touch the other people. That contact, you know, whereas Gleeson went as far as to say one religion can learn from another religion. You know, we really have to take this very seriously. And I learned that mostly unconsciously. It's only the last 5 years, my contacts, my work on Gleeson and so on, that I began to take that as a form of didacticism. But the other place I talk about is Mr. Henry's, where Roberta Flack used to play. All these things, I say, what happened? And this is so big now, and they have, you know, Subway and all these things. So I look for myself. But you're absolutely right about this notion of, on the one hand, we're very worried about being contaminated by others. But on the other hand, if the world is to have any future, we have to enter in contact. I think it's very, and the change is now automatic. It's gradual in many ways. And Gleeson used to say something also that's very threatening, especially to young people. He said, and this is also in Mandan area. In my area, there is a song called Kominjiara, that which is good. So if your story is very good, it doesn't belong to you anymore. It becomes everybody else's. You know, if you tell a good story or do a nice painting, of course you can say, they stole my stuff, they appropriated it, but when the story is good, it doesn't belong to you anymore. Gleeson says this, and this song also says it. You know, and it's by Hank Jones, who's an African-American, Sheikh Tijan Sheikh, who's Malian. So they got together, they sang this song called Kominjiara. Kominjiara, jama obena, komi maja, jama. When the song is good, it will attract the crowd. When the song is not good, no one will show up.
And that's basically.
So it doesn't belong to you anymore.
Well, and I think what's profound about that, I mean, you'll see in the song, you know, Fikre very, very rarely signed his paintings. Sometimes he would sign them Fikre G. And I would say, like, well, I don't even understand. I sign my poems. I want people to know that I wrote them. And I think that what I now understand, it was a release. Was that this story, this painting, it's out there. You know, you let it go, and it represents more than just the individual who calls it forth. Okay, we have to stop now, but I want to thank all of you for coming to again thank the National Gallery for an extraordinary day and a rare and beautiful event. And to you, my darling, thank you so much. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.